So was it immediately evident when you marketed Tylenol with its, all its approvals that it was a runaway product?
Not at all. No, we marketed it 2 months after we got our food and drug, our NDA, which was April of 55, and in May we marketed, and we had sufficient success that 2 years later we put in a NDA for drops, Tylenol drops, which we, because the pediatrician felt that it was so safe that he would like to have another form for very little tots. Pour out your tongue and put the dropper, you would put it, you see, right on the tongue. And so that product followed along and supported the our business with the pediatrician.
And then I know one time you talked to me about the decision to go over the counter. But between drops and going over the counter, there's some other stages
in
the development of
The question of whether we should make a tablet came up because physicians had use for a tablet. And so in 1961, we submitted an application for a tablet. And because it was safe for use, the tablet was marketed so it could be sold over the counter. Remember, the prescription products had caution to be used only by or on the prescription of a physician, and were restricted to prescription use. But we then had a product which, of course, could be sold to on prescription or over the counter. A physician could prescribe it, and a pharmacist could sell it.
So when was codeine added to the mixture?
Well, because our clinical investigation group felt that there was a use for a combination, and we, as a company, had sold many combination of products, including one that included acetaminophen by that time. And so it was quite natural that they thought of codeine, and so we undertook clinical studies and filed an application with Tylenol and codeine in three strings. And the product was known as Tylenol with codeine 1, 2, and 3. So the physician, and that cleared FDA in 1963. I'll check.
And that's the pediatric form of that is the one that was the most prescribed?
Not the pediatric, no.
Oh.
Adult.
Okay.
Number three became
the most prescribed.
Number three, because the doctor then felt he had, you see, cases, an indefinite number of cases where he wanted to step up the effectiveness of codeine and Tylenol, and the two together worked out so well, and again, safer than aspirin.
And so that's the one, it's the, what is it?
Well, number three then became, yes, McNeil's biggest seller in 1967.
And it was the most prescribed drug of the whole, of every drug, any drug, right?
Well, it, I can't be safe to say that, but I can say that it was the eighth product to reach 1 million prescriptions a month. And
That's big.
I'd have to look up some of the statistics,
right.
I think, to answer it. It could have been, but I would have to check. If you want that in? If you want in, I'll ask one of the boys. Did I put it in your... Because we had one of the fellows from Soros, who was a junior,
right.
Edit... That's all right. Edit, you know, that part of it.
Right.
And I had somebody from Control edit the other side, just so you had a product that was...
As near to correct.
Cleared by both of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That was the year ago, last March draft.
Right.
So whatever was said there would have been cleared by the... go ahead.
So now we did slide right by 1959 when McNeil was acquired by Johnson & Johnson. And how did that happen? Or why did it happen?
Well, our development as a company had proceeded to the point where we realized that we would have to expand the plant, and rather than do it on the present site, we initiated, we made the decision in 56 that we should, with projections, and that we would have to do it. I then was the senior officer of the company, and it was based on sales and the need for more laboratories, the need for more plant to expand, and consequently we decided to look at sites, and in 1957 we engaged a consultant in real estate and looked at sites that were approximately 100 acres. Everybody thought we were crazy to look at a site that big, but we came up with approximately 26 that were given consideration, and of them we selected the one in Fort Washington, which we then purchased from three different owners, primarily because we were based in North Philadelphia, and that was the one that appeared to be the most convenient for our employees.
Mm-hmm.
So that we had, that I think got the attention as well as the reputation of McNeil, Johnson & Johnson. And so in 1958, in the fall, we were approached by Harry McKenzie and Gus Leinhart of Johnson & Johnson to see if we would become one of their companies and operate independently, but based on their concept of Johnson & Johnson being a company of independent companies.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to give it some very careful thought. We had not considered a merger. We hadn't had any discussions with anyone. We had been approached to see whether or not we wanted to go public, because a great concern to me and my brother and others inside was the need for capital for expansion and continuing. And expansion meant not only physical facilities but also personnel.
Mm-hmm.
So we did not know that Johnson, at that point, that Johnson & Johnson had tried twice to get into the pharmaceutical prescription field and had not been successful. But we told them we would give it some thought, and after considerable discussion, and there were five reasons that I had as to that were really dictated my decision, because my father and mother didn't want to participate. They felt that dad and the time, and they felt that it was up to my brother and to me. And he studied it from the point of view of sales and marketing, and one of those five factors why we told them that we wouldn't give consideration, and they much soul searching, why we entered into confidential discussions with them, and I made the decision that I did not want to go with them and conveyed that. But it ended up with their satisfying our concerns, however, they insisted that I go for a period of time in transition, or the deal was off. So I had no other choice, I felt, than to go ahead and set 7 years as for transition with retirement of all responsibilities at that time. So those, you probably want to know what those five reasons are.
Right, right.
Well, one of them was capital, because we had never taken anything out of the business. And to expand, buy property, build plants, and to add research, of course, meant there was need for capital. We can, of course, go public and get it, but they assured us that they would not only support the expansion we planned, but encouraged us to even build a little more in research, for research.
And was Johnson & Johnson at that point publicly traded? Was Johnson & Johnson publicly
yes.
traded? It was.
Yes.
I know it is now, but.
Yes. And they were then a company of $329 million. And this year they reported $19
billion. I thought $329 million sounds a lot to me.
And so it, off the record now, so did they. They thought that was a lot. It was. Well, we'll scratch that.
Okay.
But now, the first was capital. The second thing was that we had to consider was expansion of research department, which they encouraged. And we came to the conclusion, as McNeil, that as a small company, we couldn't continue at our rate, that we would need more people, and that the day for a company our size to compete with the Merck's and, was really drawing to a close.
Mm-hmm.
And the next consideration was overseas. We were in 20 countries then, but we were selling our products there, but we didn't have our own company. We weren't manufacturing over there, and we weren't making any money over there. And in other words, we had to build and set up, and that, of course, required capital. And J&J said that they would take our products and distribute them under J&J International. We wouldn't have McNeil, but they wanted to set up a J&J International. We would give the formulas and everything to somebody in Brazil, and that was one of the first companies, and we would set them up, and they, which we did, and then went ahead and with marketing our products, not under our name, but under their name. And then, so overseas expansion. The next was our employees. We had a very loyal group, and I was more concerned with them than any other factor, and to expand and develop on our own, there was a risk. And I was able to work out with J&J the assurance that every one of them would be covered and all of their term of employment recognized, so that they were 100% secure in their retirement. And to me, that I was indebted to them, and that was very much a factor with me. And then the fifth thing was more personal, and that is I've been in the company for 20 years. Others haven't heard this, I might add. But I was thinking, boy, it's going to be 27 plus by the time I'm through. Do I want to do this the rest of my life? Because I spent Saturdays and Sundays during the war. We worked right on through. So I had to think of myself and question whether or not I was going to spend that much time and effort. And I had married in 56, and I had a stepson and then a daughter of my own that was only a year old then, but with the expectation of other children. And I have let's say intellectual curiosity, and my second career, I thought, well, what am I going to do? Well, along with business, because I wanted to do that, I also had with my wife this idea of studying Americana and our national heritage through collection of antiques, and something that I could do with her, but also to satisfy my own intellectual curiosity and interest, and then start a foundation. Well, I had started a foundation. I hadn't started it, but with the Johnson & Johnson, I did start in 1964. It was the Robert McNeil Foundation, but I changed it to Barra, so that I didn't want my name in it. So I had, my second career had three parts as I projected.
Mm-hmm. So you actually retired from McNeil, what, 1964, 1966?
Well, we reached the point where, well, first I would explain that my brother, 5 months after we merged, had a heart attack and never became an active executive of McNeil after that.
Terrible.
So
he's your younger brother, so he's in his 30s, right?
Well, 40s. I had to late no, but he remained technically on the board, but then J&J picked him up to do promotional and trade relations where they could use him, and it wasn't full time, so it was easy on him, and he continued but died 83.
Hmm.
If you want that date, of course I can check on that, but may remember well. So we waited a year, and then Harry McKenzie and I, remember Harry was the member of the J&J Executive Committee, had responsibility for McNeil. So I, in essence, followed the direction they wanted to go, knowing I was going to be out. This wasn't announced to anybody that I would be going out. But then we selected someone to head up sales and move up as president, and then as we moved along, it became apparent that in 64, I think it was, that I would devote my time to other McNeil things but not be active.
Mm-hmm.
And I've stayed and worked on two or three projects for McNeil. But it was also the understanding that I did not, you see, work for other J&J companies. I mean, by that, it was from the beginning. I'll correct the notes on that. But from the beginning that I, when we said, okay, we'll go ahead, well, I even had signed an employment agreement and non-compete in that was effective from January 1st, 59 on. And the understanding was, you know, I came from McNeil. So it was never fully announced. I just tapered off.
Mm-hmm.
And was considered the best. In the meantime, Harry McKenzie was killed in an automobile accident, which was a really unfortunate because he was a very decent type of fellow, a capable one. And they had to replace him with another member of the executive committee, and so I don't want to go into more detail. I'll cut that all out, but go ahead.
Well, perhaps we should charge ahead into your second careers, because there were three careers that you were thinking about pursuing.
Well, the first career was business, where I didn't want to become, active in the management side, but act as a counselor. And so I got into, with groups in the venture capital and many different areas, and then brought in an MBA-er to do this work, to head up venture capital for me. And I was in, I won't take the time, but venture capital, investment, oil and gas, real estate, in different areas.
Uh-huh.
And as many as 25 at a time.
Now, were you prohibited by your agreement with Johnson & Johnson of pursuing pharmaceutical?
To get into ethical pharmaceuticals.
Okay.
So I was in other areas such as medical devices, and one of my for 25 years I've been on the board and worked with a company called Arrow, which is now public, and which is the one that you've read about having the left ventricular assist device in patients, which is an extraordinary development, but has grown to a very substantial company, and that's typical of what I've been in, and enjoy the associations and the challenges, and you see, contributed in a different way.
So yeah, at some point you were on the board of 25 different companies, or?
Well, I was, many of them were partnerships, but let's say I was on the board of half a dozen operating companies, or a partner in real estate partnerships, you see, and still am in a few. So, but I brought in after, and I'm still working with the that MBA-er who represents me, you see, on this Arrow International board now, and other, some other ventures of mine, and then I've subsequently had other MBAs, but I've tried to wind them down. At my age, everybody, including myself, agrees the time has come. I ought to, so that I've been the last 5 years been trying to liquidate and get out, and I retired from the boards. About the last one about 2 years ago because of SEC responsibilities and the rest, why I felt that it was prudent. But then, of course, I was also operating a foundation as president of the Barrow Foundation.
So you said that was founded in 1964?
Yes. But it came into its own in the last 20 years, where we have a specific objective, and I will fill that in to save you time. I can tell you concretely, and I can give you our policy statement. So why don't I do that?
Okay.
To save time.
Right, or if you want to talk about a couple of projects that you're
thinking about. Well, I'll give you a list of projects on National Heritage, which I had to make up for a medal I'm getting soon. I'll give you that, just to save time. And I'll give you, we have three trusts, pilot projects, publications, and I'll give you the list of publications, this being one. And the third area, and we're getting out of that, is we do a certain amount of community work, small amounts to struggling non-profits in the fields of our interests, which are human services, health, education, and arts and culture. Those four. So, but our principal thrust is this project, which I will develop with a little sentence, and I'll give you a statement that's available to everybody. I have one here I can dig out, but that is the foundation side, and the personal side is studying our national culture with a collection of that represents and illustrates our development in the period of 1750 to 1825, when we went from colonies to become a nation, and in the Philadelphia area. And that's why that side of it is of interest to me, because it's not only in front of collecting, but that led me into being on the White House Committee, the Commission on National Portrait Gallery, and some of these other extracurricular activities.
Do you think, I know it has something to do with your ancestry, but I was thinking of your mother. Do you think that these activities are things that would have pleased your mother as an artist? Or?
It would have delighted her, because her mother, Phelps, had an ancestor who was on the Mayflower, Brewster, a carver on the next boat, a Phelps. She was a Phelps. From the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and settled Windsor in 1634. And so there was a very strong feeling, you see, about doing things. My grandfather was a congregational minister, so the idea of doing things for others and giving back was definitely part of her philosophy. She was a Wellesley graduate in 1912, and came to Philadelphia to teach art. So I'm sure she had been delighted.
Good.
Was that it?
Yes. Well, what about your own children? Have they followed in footsteps in any way, or done the American thing and done something totally different?
You want, well, to begin with, they were too young, you see, to get involved in pharmaceutical. They didn't even know what I was doing, except the stepson, who was six when I married. The others were too young, and I would say they each followed their own path. But I also would add that Johnson & Johnson had a policy back in those days of not employing anybody that was a son of an executive.
Is that something?
I don't know what it is today, but no.
That's what they call it, nepotism rules.
Yeah. I'm going to flip the
table. Okay, and you need to...